This is Marketing Spice, a podcast by Pimento.
You've got this playing field that's far from level, and you have expectations that are being increased all the time in line with the range of experiences that people have.
We're seeing an upsurge in this sector, just as we did in takeaway delivery and home-cooked fresh ingredients. There's likely to be an inevitable consolidation to a couple of lead brands.
Hello there, I'm Paddy Woods and welcome back to Marketing Spice, the podcast from Pimento. In every episode, we're looking at all aspects of marketing. We cover the latest trends and advice from agency leaders from a variety of different fields along the way. But in this episode, we're talking about food and drink. It's another area that has seen an unprecedented shift with consumer behaviour since the start of the pandemic, and is continuing to do so as consumers look at different needs across health and well-being, sustainability agendas, indulgence, and transparency. So what do brands need to be thinking about right now as they look at their strategies for the future? This is Marketing Spice. So thanks again for listening to Marketing Spice, and it's time to meet our first guest to talk through some key trends in food and drink in 2022. Joining me is Paul Hannigan, who is the founder of Gastronomic Agency, a food specialist agency based in London.
Thanks very much for having me.
I think I'm looking forward to this one because I think you're in this really interesting space, and I just wanted to start to build on the sort of the conversation, which is starting with around authenticity, and it's a key part of consumer needs at the moment. And in your book, Gastronomic Marketing, you talk about food and drink companies, how they can utilize eating and gastronomy to build deeper, more authentic relationships with brands. What are the key things brands should be doing to help build these relationships that meet in that food and drink and sort of gastronomy at this moment in time?
For me, it comes down to a kind of an authentic why, a real reason and a brand story behind why somebody should actually engage with your product, be that food and drink or a spice or seasoning or things like that. People need to connect with why you exist instead of just shopping on price or other metrics. So I think for brands, especially with the marketing sphere changing so much over the past couple of years, it really comes down to classic why you exist and why you make the consumer's life better.
There's this whole thing about healthier lifestyles and healthier living, but featuring these moments, key moments where they want to escape and almost hedonistic indulgence, where they sort of really focus on enjoyment and letting themselves go, and they forget about that healthier lifestyle they've been leading. But this change has led to consumers being much more demanding in the products they purchase, and they're looking for genuine experiences from the products they buy. Now, given your this experience of both being a trained chef, sommelier, and now an agency owner, it'd be great to talk about how brands should be looking to develop their products and content to deliver towards these hedonistic moments.
Yeah, so there's a couple of points on that. I don't think they're mutually exclusive. So like, we're working with clients now to develop campaigns around like healthy hedonism. For example, last year alone, there was a 400% increase in the sales of air fryers from John Lewis. So people are looking for that healthy, hedonistic kind of approach. So we develop different kind of recipes and campaigns around things like buttermilk air fried chicken, so people can still have that moment in time without having to run 20 kilometers to work off their meals. But you are quite right that there is a lot more time and resource, I think, spent by people looking into what they're buying. They're buying a lot more locally, they're buying a lot more seasonally, and they're really trying to be more conscious consumers. So when you're trying to tap into the kind of hedonism side of things, again, you need to kind of go back to why people are looking to be hedonistic. Is it they have maybe friends over? Is it that it's a healthy treat? So you have to kind of anchor that why instead of just trying to sell them something indulgent. This whole kind of smash and grab type of marketing that you've been seeing online around kind of food porn and, you know, things that people would never really cook, but it'll get clicks. For me, that doesn't quite work in building brand loyalty and repeat custom.
And sort of taking that sort of brand loyalty and that sort of actually, as you said, talk about food porn, it's how do brands start to think about doing that differently so that actually they're focusing really on the benefits and that sort of authenticity as we sort of talked about, and actually that sort of conscious consumer? How should brands be looking to really build on that?
It's a very good question. A lot of that comes down to the individual brand and what they're trying to do with their marketing. Like for me, it's comes down to the three E's. So there has to be empathy in what you're trying to do. So if you're trying to sell a seasoning, you have to understand why the consumer would be using that seasoning. Is it so they cook better food for their family? Is it so they can have a better experience in a dinner party? Then you need to educate them. So how could you use it? Again, using the spice example, how many spices sit in a cupboard for years and years and years and never get used because nobody really knows how to use them apart from in Christmas pudding that they bought them for or something like that, where you're able to create really, really good recipes and equip them with education. And then the last one is energy. So again, taking the spice example, because that just seems to be top of my mind at the moment. It needs to be energetic. There needs to be a real strong reason why. Now, the food porn can come into that to use that, but there has to be depth to that instead of just it just being clickbaity. There has to be like, wow, I really want to try this at home. And then you're able to nurture them through your digital marketing techniques, whether that's email or competitions or influencer, whatever that happens to be. But there has to be that body of work, that body of recipes, content, really fun, engaging and energetic content that will help people use that product again and again and again. And ultimately, that means that it ends up being a staple in their larder. So that's what we kind of work on with our clients is defined in that. And that changes per brand. Like even if you look at gins, the reason why a certain gin exists as opposed to another gin, they're very, very different with how you would target them instead of it just being a category. So we would change our campaigns accordingly to sit in with that brand's end goal.
Do you know what? So it's so true. Going back to that, so it's the spice sitting in the larder. I think we did a clear out the other day, and I think we found some from 2015. it's really awful, and it's like, but you buy a spice for a certain reason, and it's how do you then start to build that opportunities? And what sort of process do you go with brands? And you talked about the three E's, taking that down deeper. How do you start to engage with those consumers to say, look, you bought Chinese Five Spice or whatever it is? How do you go about building that opportunity for brands to really have that engagement with consumers?
So for us, in what we do, it's quite unique because it's led by food and drink professionals. And we look at it not from our ego, but from what the end consumer can actually use. So usually with chefs, it's about where they worked, how they can cook. But there's no point in us doing foams and hairs and things like that because no one's going to cook it at home. So how we start is a kind of deep dive into trend analysis and the research into the company. So usually if they're an established brand, there'll be some really good collateral that they've developed maybe 20, 30 years ago that will inform our campaign. So we start kind of looking at social trends, what's going to happen, where the markets are going. And then we deep dive into the products research, the company's history, products history, and then also competitor as well. And then from there, we start to kind of form ideas around content. And then the content becomes the linchpin for the campaign. So for example, if we were doing something around a spice, we might take a biscuit that, or a cookie that has a kind of a spice element, redefine that in a certain way. So it's really, really engaging, exciting content. And then we're able to build off the back of that. And that might lead into a kind of whole overarching campaign, or it might just be that kind of one product, but generally it's a whole overarching campaign. So yeah, it was quite unique in how we kind of approach things because it's starting with the end in mind and working backwards and then creating the content accordingly instead of it just being nice, pretty pictures.
And it's very much about disrupting what is the status quo and the normal way of doing things, which is actually spices have a certain sort of thing. And that's all about that experimentation side of things.
No, 100%, 100%. And it's not just about spices. So I just pick that as example because it's kind of in my mind, but like across food and drink, if you're saying again gin, because I was at an event last night, so gin is the other side of my mind, you're looking at them and they all have a reason for being, like an ikigai, a reason why they exist, and they're just trying to, like when you're talking to the owners or the CEOs, they're like, oh, we just want to get it on the back bar of a 5-star hotel. And they're starting with the kind of the wrong aspect. Yes, you want to get there, but there's a much bigger market than just having it in 5-star hotels in central London. And really defining that and pinning that reason why on the back of your content is ultimately how you succeed. And it's an interesting kind of, there's people are starting to turn around to that now, especially as socials are getting hit with the iOS updates and things like that. It's coming back to more pure marketing.
Brilliant. And actually take this the conversation around experimentation to a sort of a step forward, which is the fusion of digital and physical and sort of consumers looking for that more experimental, unusual flavors. And brands are starting to look at how they can then bring digital into this world and alternative realities. And Coke have created this new innovation platform. And one of the products they're sort of releasing for, I think, 6 months is Starlight, which is what they're calling a space Coke, which they basically imagined how space might taste.
Brilliant.
And it's fascinating. But it's what they're then doing is they're selling it actually in reality, but also on digital. And how do brands start to engage and showcase these weird and wonderful, exceedingly random flavors, I suppose, and bring them to life to engage consumers and that need for experimentation? So that Coke is a prime example of that.
Absolutely. And that duality is the way forward. One of our customers that we worked with, they were a vegan cheese brand, and they needed to kind of find more of a context on how people could use this vegan cheese. So we kind of worked backwards from going through our process, found out that the kind of core dishes that people miss, that kind of cheesiness that they miss when they go vegan. And then we recreated those as vegan dishes. So that was kind of the digital aspect. So there was recipes, and there might be some overarching campaigns that we're working on this year based on them, because there are spin-off kind of campaigns that would end up being amazing. But then we activated that with a sampling event in Spitalfields, kind of getting customer reactions. And of course, people were going, yeah, this is unbelievable. I can't believe it's vegan. It hit that kind of unctuous note that people miss, that creaminess, that mouthfeel that they miss when ultimately they're not eating dairy. So that was kind of the approach of kind of arming people with content and real content that works, that's easily done, but still is unbelievably delicious. And then actually bringing that to create digital assets and actually have a physical experience around it too.
Brilliant. And just shifting again to brands now having a much more looking for this whole direct to consumer. And we've got a lot of startups moving into this direct to consumer space. They're in this position where they often get stuck in their growth and not sure what to do. Mm-hmm. What advice would you give a startup on helping them scale their business? Because it's another unique part of what you guys do.
Yeah, so we have what's called the Inc. Accelerator, a group of startups kind of pre-100K revenue who are trying to basically get their business off the ground. So it's going to be an education piece on how to, like an online course on kind of rudimentary Facebook, Google advertising, because we do that as that's kind of our core service. We have the creative agency approach and then the digital agency as well. Yeah, so we'll be teaching them how to kind of get them to a certain stage in their growth. And then also we'll have guest kind of speakers coming in to talk about the entrepreneurial journey and give advice. And then we'll have coaching calls on whatever that might be, whether it's their mindset, their website's broken, their Facebook campaigns aren't working. So my advice for startup food and drink companies is get involved in a community, because you can ask questions, you can tap into knowledge, so you don't need to repeat the same mistakes other people did. And also really think about your marketing instead of just running things like Facebook ads and throwing 500 quid at Facebook ads, which probably won't work, because nowadays you really need to be very, very clear on what you're doing and why you're doing it. So I would say, yes, surround yourself in a good community and really think through your why and why people should listen to you instead of being engrossed in your product. You need to separate yourself from the product a little bit to kind of go, oh, is this actually a really good offer? Is it a really good product? Do I know the audience? Do I have good creative?
Yeah, and I think that's so true, especially around sort of the why and actually who, because again, sometimes it's that you've got to be quite niche about what you're doing, and then you can scale it, build it that way. Paul, that is the end of our conversation. So thank you really very much for your time. I've really enjoyed chatting, and I think there's some really interesting sort of opportunities around that sort of mixture of flavoring, exoticism, sort of escapism, that sort of, I think you really tap into. So thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure. Thanks very much for having me.
Hi, I'm Judith Doherty from Simple Usability. We're a behavioural research agency, and we spend a lot of time working with our clients to understand what their experience is, are like. I think we're moving from a period of, you know, people perhaps having a little bit more time on their hands during the pandemic, people being in their home more, people, you know, engaging with things such as catalogues and magazine content, you know, more fully than perhaps they're going to in the future. And so really we're back to a point where you've got incredibly time-poor individuals who just want experiences made as simple and as pleasing as possible.
Thanks again to Paul from Gastronomics. Really interesting to hear his thoughts on how brands can tap into consumer need for indulgence. Moving on, I would like to now introduce you to Chris Thornhill, who is the co-founder and CEO of Growth Animals, an ethical growth marketing agency. Chris, welcome to Marketing Spice.
Thank you very much, Paddy. It's a pleasure.
It's great to have you here. And I suppose just let's get this sort of topic started, is this whole agenda around sustainability and conflict between carbon neutrality and quick commerce, changing habits around diet, reductions in meat to plant-based alternatives. There's so much, but I could go on. What I really wanted to start with, given that you are a sort of ethical growth marketing agency, it'd be great to get your thoughts on what you think the role is for this sustainable ethical marketing for the food and drink sector.
Yeah, I mean, food and drink is a sector that I feel is both leading the way actually in a lot of cases, but also needs to lead the way around sustainability practices and ethical marketing, because it's so consumer facing. It's so there at the front line, if you like, of what people are experiencing day to day. And so the expectations are that, you know, these are the types of brands and businesses that need to be making steps overtly to help us have a better planet. I think people are really aware of the fact that consumption in general, mass consumption and over excessive consumption, is one of the key drivers towards global warming and excess waste and excess plastic and so forth. And so as a result, this sector really does have a massive responsibility to step up and be the change. And now actually I've been doing a bit of research for a guide to ethical marketing that I've been building with my team. And as part of that, I've been having a few conversations with some leading sort of progressive businesses, let's say, across the sector. And a lot of them have been saying to me that, look, if you look at the number of companies in the UK that are B Corp accredited now, you'll notice that food and drink is the area where there are most of those. And I think that is a real indication of how important people within that sector have seen the need to make that step. But also, interestingly, I think it shows that the food and drink sector can be leaders that bring along other industries with them. But also, if you're in that industry now and you're not perhaps doing sustainable practices, you're not thinking about ethical marketing, you really want to be thinking about it fast, because it might be a competitive advantage to be acting that way now. But actually, very soon, it's going to become a hygiene factor, whereby if you're not doing these things, consumers are going to walk away in their droves.
I think that's really interesting. And actually, that's a hygiene factor. There are so many big brands that have a huge shift to go through and the challenges that comes with it. And they've got the shift in terms of they need to do it, but they've also got to please their shareholder. Are there any sort of thoughts around how they could, the steps they could take to help go through that process?
Yeah, I mean, It can be very tricky, particularly for, let's say, the legacy businesses that have been around for ages and are used to doing that old capitalist mantra of, you know, just trying to generate maximum return for their shareholders and that above all else. I think the two things that are making a difference. One is that shareholders are now starting to see the value in acting responsibly. You know, even the big investment companies are now starting to disinvest in sort of fossil fuels where they can, start to invest in renewables. And so, therefore, I think it's important that this decision gets taken with the whole company, the whole senior management on board. You know, this is not just a campaign. This shouldn't be an approach that's done just to win over a few sort of climate conscious consumers. This needs to be something that's genuinely from top to bottom of an organization, becomes a real strategic driver, let's say.
And actually, one of the sort of key areas I think I'd like to move on to is this whole last 6 years have really been a roller coaster for consumers in terms of the economic situation. You've had Brexit, you've got COVID, energy crisis, run on fuel, which seems to be happening again. And now this horrible situation happening in Ukraine. What's really concerning is this sense that the majority of the consumers are really feeling this financial pressure at the moment. And it sort of reflects really heavily onto that sort of ethical approach for brands. And how can brands behave ethically to support actually this financially squeezed consumer?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And I think that there's two main areas. One is to almost make their lives easier. So there's always been a role, I think, of marketing in general, but also particularly food and drink marketing, playing this role of providing happiness or joy or those sorts of emotions. That's been sort of put to the back burner a bit as people have started to understand the negative side effects of mass consumption and so forth. But even so now, I think there's a role for brands to dig a bit deeper and to think about how they can just make people's lives that much more easier, more joyful. Also provide the role of education as well, because you know, when it comes to a lot of these areas within environmental impacts and sustainability marketing, the truth is that a lot of the time people don't have all the information at their fingertips, and they're being bombarded, just as they are with all the major news stories and so forth, with lots of little quick snippets and sound bites. But actually brands can play a really key role in being positive educators in this. So, you know, we always talk about this idea of content is king and it's great to tell stories within your marketing. Well, let's educate as part of that, because then you're not only telling a story, you're also being helpful and inspiring. So that's one way. And the second way is to think about the tactics that you do through your marketing. So a lot of the things that have always been done just because I think competitors have done it and therefore everyone feels that they all have to do it. Take a step back and think, actually, is this causing more pain to our customers? So a classic example would be, you know, scarcity marketing. It's fine to talk about the fact that you've only got two of a certain item left if you've only genuinely got two of a certain item left. But when there's these constant flash sales, when there's all these little things popping up on your screen saying five other people are looking at this now, these are all a load of false scarcity tactics that are there to create feelings of anxiety in the consumer. They're not there to help people make positive purchase decisions. So take a step back. You know, if we're looking at being real value-driven companies, purpose-driven companies that are going to help to save our environment and help to make better positive life choices, then doing these old-fashioned unethical tactics are not the way forward. And frankly, consumers are starting to see through it more and more.
I think that it's a really interesting point. It goes back to the days of Wonga and stuff like that, where actually people are getting into massive amounts of debt and still continue to do so. I think there's I've seen a massive shift in behaviours around Christmas, especially on the sort of food side of things and the retail side of things, where they're really pushing this huge table filled with food and stuff like that. And actually that goes exactly against what you've just been saying, which is actually this mass consumption isn't working. People are being much more refined around what they're sort of looking for, how they've been much more considered in their approach. And I suppose that sort of comes back into this, is that sort of how can brands start to really forward think about that sort of consumer need and consumer behavior to be much more ethical around it? So yeah, it's a minefield, but I just want to shift as well into this is another sort of part of this whole ethical approach, which is this shift for quick commerce, ultra convenience. Again, it goes back to actually, are we causing anxiety in this approach of ultra convenience? But the bigger thing is the impact on carbon footprint. I was reading a report by WHO, and I think they're saying that by sort of the next 10 years, the last mile is going to drive up pollution 78% or something. So what should brands be looking to do when it comes to managing both the need for that ultra convenience and the desire to actually reduce their impact on the environment?
Yeah, it's a great question, actually. I think, again, two things, really. The first one is, like you say, that last mile is quite an interesting concept, because I think it's one that a lot of businesses haven't thought about a great deal, but also, for sure, consumers aren't particularly aware of what is the biggest impact. Is it ordering something directly to your door? Is it driving to a shop and buying it along with a bunch of other stuff at the same time? What is the best carbon footprint? And the truth is that there's no straight answer to that. You know, you need to do a bit of digging, because it may be that for a brand that is just created and made and sold literally in the same county as you live in, it may be best to go direct yourself. But if it's a product that is a few counties north of you, then it might be better that it's sent directly to your door. So I think there's a bit of work that the brands need to do to help the customers understand which of the options to purchase are the better ones for them from a carbon footprint point of view. A good example of this actually is there's a brand I was talking to recently called Scandinavis, which is a sort of Nordic beauty and care creams, that sort of thing, organic creams. And they recently made a move to ensure that they always give their best prices to their subscribers, and any sort of sales they do, even if they were to participate in, say, a Black Friday, the price that those offers go to is always worse than it would be to their subscribers. And part of that is to try and move away from this general discounting thing, which isn't particularly healthy anyway. But the other driver there is that they've worked out that for the vast majority of customers, it makes far more sense from a carbon footprint point of view for them to send their products direct to their door rather than sell through an intermediary like Amazon, for example, where it goes to a warehouse and then it goes on back to the customer, or for the customer to go and actually buy it directly from a beauty shop near them or something along those lines. So it's really important, I think, that brands start to think about that and therefore put in both incentives, but also the information for their consumers to understand what is the best route to purchase from a carbon offset point of view. The other big factor, I think, is that, you know, we talked about the negative side of FMCG or general consumption being, let's say, unnecessary, and that over time capitalism has driven unnecessary consumption. So I think there's a real role to be played now in this idea of substitution marketing. So your product as a better alternative to something that someone would have already purchased rather than buy this product that you've never bought before, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it does. And actually, I think what's really interesting, there's two things that sort of, I thought really resonated with me, is the tactics of that subscription marketing. I think we're seeing this huge need, and it's very much driven by, I think, the younger audiences, where they're already subscribing to the likes of Netflix and other channels. It's integrating this huge move for subscription marketing and the subscription model.
Yeah.
And I think it's going back to this whole world where brands are really struggling with this move from a traditional retail-led approach to actually how do we start to engage directly with our consumers around data, et cetera, like that. And how do we start to bring more opportunities and to save the environment? I think Pepsi have got a great example in the Netherlands, where any product that they can't sell, they're actually reboxing up and selling directly to consumers as a sort of mixed box of surprise goodies, whether it's from Pepsi, which they couldn't get rid of.
Mm.
I'll have to find out what it's called. But I suppose from your perspective, going back to that sort of need to go direct to consumer and subscription modeling, is how to go about doing that, because it's a big shift and it's a big change, and there's changing programs, it's changing platforms, it's changing infrastructure and journeys. And it's a sort of, what sort of roles, I suppose, should agencies be advising those brands on that sort of approach?
Yeah, I think, you know, from a number of levels. So from a strategic level, there's the guidance around the type of messaging, the type of advantages that it can give to you, the brand, because, you know, going direct is far more profitable than going through all of these previously huge retailers that want to take a huge chunk out of your margin. And then secondly, is the carbon impact of that decision, and the fact that that does normally mean that it's a more environmentally friendly product than doing it the old-fashioned way. And then, of course, there's the messaging that goes behind that. And I think a lot of brands that do subscription marketing very well know the fact that there is this extra, let's say, buffer within their margins that they are benefiting from versus the old model. And therefore, they're able to incentivize customers to come on that journey with them even more, whether that be through better prices, as with the Scandinavis example, or with free gifts that come with every purchase, proper free gifts as well. You know, there's some fantastic examples of, for example, little taster bottles of whiskey with certain whiskey subscriptions, you know, free snacks with various beer subscriptions, all these things that actually do have a value to the consumer, but actually are not a huge chunk of the margin to take out when you're doing a direct-to-consumer subscription model. And then, of course, agencies have a massive role in providing the tech solutions, because there's a lot of fantastic agencies out there who are very digitally savvy and therefore can help make the decisions around what are the right platforms to do this upon, what's the right user experience for the user if they do opt for this solution, as opposed to going through the traditional grocers and what have you before. So I think, yeah, whether you're looking at this from a strategic, communications, tactical point of view, there is many roles that agencies can support with on this.
Brilliant. Chris, thank you. It's really been an interesting discussion. So thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure. It's been a lot of fun. Thanks.
My name is David Law, founder of Someone, a branding agency based in London and Sydney. For the customer, the introductory promotion phase is fantastic, and brands are spending huge amounts of money on marketing aiming for loyalty. The flip side of this is that many younger digital native customers chase the promotions and voucher codes, so there's actually very little loyalty between apps. And loyalty is, of course, the hallmark of a great brand.
And that brings us to the end of this episode of Marketing Spice. And it's been a really interesting one where we've been looking at the whole food and drink sector and some key trends affecting them over the coming year. Thank you again to Paul Hannigan from Gastronomics and Chris Thornhill from The Growth Animals. If you have any queries about anything you've heard, please do get in touch via the website and check out our blog too. In the next podcast, we're going to shift our focus to the travel sector. Thanks again for listening. Please do subscribe so you don't miss the next episode. This has been Marketing Spice.
Find out more about the latest trends and insights in marketing at pimento.co.uk.
You may know you're listening to this show along the Marketing Podcast Network, but did you know there are other great shows on MPN to help your business? Christy Hyler hosts a fantastic podcast called Own It. Christy, tell us more about the show.
Own It is all about celebrating women and non-binary advertising agency owners. We talk about buying out of the Boys Club of Advertising because less than 1% of ad agencies are owned by women.
And where can people subscribe?
You can find the podcast at untilyouownit.com. We're also on the Marketing Podcast Network at marketingpodcast.net. And of course, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
You heard her. Go subscribe. This podcast is heard along the Marketing Podcast Network. For more great marketing podcasts, visit marketingpodcasts.net.